Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing coverage of immigration and children who have been separated from their parents. A little later in the show, Manny Fernandez, Houston Bureau Chief for the New York Times, will join us to talk about what he saw on Wednesday in a Walmart-turned-children detention center in Brownsville, Texas. But first, we are discussing coverage of the U.S.-North Korea summit. Journalist Tim Shorrock is just back from Korea, where he covered the meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. He reports that the media response from both liberals and conservatives betrays a cynical disregard for South Korea. He says that he watched the initial hours of the Trump-Kim encounter from the International Media Center in downtown Singapore, where over 2,500 reporters from around the world gathered to cover the summit. Tim Shorrock is an independent journalist, frequent contributor to The Nation, and author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And Tim's latest piece in The Nation is called Trump Meets Kim, Averting Threat of Nuclear War, and U.S. Pundits Are Furious. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Good morning or good afternoon, whatever it is.
Whatever it is. I know you just landed. So thank you so much, Tim, for joining us. Tim, before we dive in and talk about what you saw there and the meeting itself, I want to ask you what you think about coverage of North Korea, because I watched a lot of the TV coverage and it was just a lot of pundits who clearly don't know much about Korea, really just talking about what everything looked like, what it was like to see them shake hands and all of that. But what about coverage of North Korea and what life is like in that country for North Koreans?
Well, as far as the coverage of the summit went, and by the way, you said I just returned from Korea. I just returned from Singapore, you know, where the summit was. The coverage was just—it's about the worst I've ever seen. I think it was arrogant, it was clueless. But as I wrote in that article, it completely ignores, you know, South Korea completely, or the Korean interest in the peace process there, and how much support there is in you know, particularly in South Korea for the peace process. I mean, all they did on these various networks, you know, MSNBC, CNN, they were horrified at the fact that the North Korean flag and the U.S. flag were, you know, equal. They were horrified by the fact that, you know, Trump shook hands with the dictator of North Korea, and on it went. There was nothing about, you know, the importance of, you know, what this really means for the Korean people, what it means for the United States' role in Korea. There was virtually nothing about that. It's all told from the perspective of how this might affect Trump or, you know, some other kind of, but it's basically an America-first approach. And I just found it awful to get the reports of what had appeared in the U.S. media.
Yeah, I didn't learn much. I mean, for people who don't know, I mean, we want to do an entire show on North Korea, but also just U.S. relations with North and South Korea. What sort of historical context do you think the media should have included in the reporting?
Well, you know, first of all, the background of this, of course, you know, goes way back, you know, to the Korean War. What happened then? What happened afterwards? And then, you know, what's led up to this in terms of the, you know, the nuclear crisis over the last, you know, 20 years or so. You know, basically, the way that it's portrayed in the U.S. press is that, you know, North Korea, you know, became this, you know, big nuclear threat, and they can now hit the United States with nuclear weapons. And every time we've had an agreement, they've broken it. And, you know, now, you know, the U.S. is trying to, you know, change that dynamic. Well, in fact, you know, there was agreement in the past between the U.S. and North Korea, which North Korea held to for about 12 years. This was the agreement I'm talking about, is the one between President Clinton and Kim Jong-il, who was, you know, Kim Jong-un's father, back in 1994. And actually, that agreement, you know, came apart during the Bush administration, because the Bush administration basically, you know, came to office after this agreement that had frozen North Korea's nuclear program. The Bush administration came to office to derail the agreement, and they did in 2002. and they this story is never told, and so it's always looked at as this quote unquote crazy country, for some odd reason, threatening the United States with nuclear weapons, as if the United States, didn't destroy them during the Korean War and has had nuclear weapons pointed at them, for decades and still does. And, so there's this whole, missing context that in this story and that the way it's covered. So I would say that, you really need to look at, the press really needs to look at, what's happened over the last, 20 years in a real way, and what North Korea did, if it did break an agreement, how it did it, in fact, and then what the U.S. response was and how the U.S. broke agreements as well. Mm. And put it in that larger context. But an even larger context, of course, is, the fact that you have a president in South Korea, Moon Jae-in, who was elected in 2017 on the power of a candlelight revolution that had thrown out, the past president for corruption. And, people in Korea really want to have, a good government that represents the people and that will do something about defusing the tensions with North Korea and going back to a situation where they're on better relations, in economic ways, cultural ways, all kinds of ways. And that's, Moon Jae-in's party, just two days ago, won local elections all over South Korea, overwhelmingly pushed out the opposition, which, of course, has the same position as the, many of the liberals here do, that, this agreement is no good. And they lost very badly, these conservatives in South Korea. And so, it's almost like if you read the U.S. press, that South Korea just does not even exist. Hmm. And it's 50 million people do not exist. And there's, of course, a great need, to have coverage of what's really going on in North Korea and, what the full story is behind their prison system and the defectors that leave. Why do defectors leave? And, what's been turned around? I mean, what Kim Jong-un apparently is trying to do with his country in terms of trying to improve its economy and, change its relationship to the United States and South Korea. I mean, I think that, all those things deserve, a lot of coverage, and I'm hoping that as a result of this, there will be more coverage of that and more reporters going to North Korea.
Could you go to North Korea, Tim?
Well, I could, but I would have to be approved by the U.S. State Department because, after last year, after this young American student died and after returning from captivity in North Korea, Otto Warmbier, Congress passed legislation and then the State Department instituted a travel ban of Americans to North Korea, the first time ever. So about a year ago, North Americans cannot go there, but you can apply for a special visa to go there that has to meet certain standards set by the State Department. And basically, it has to meet, do something positive for U.S. national security. So I'm certainly going to apply for one. I've never been to the DPRK, as it's called, and I would like to go there, and I'd like to do some reporting there.
Where do you go for information about North Korea, Tim? Because, Frontline had an undercover documentary a couple of years ago. This morning, NPR had a defector on the show, Sungju Lee, and he was talking about human rights. But where do you go for information about North Korea?
I go more into the Korean press. I mean, the South Korean press. I mean, South Korea covers North Korea far better than any U.S. press. And they're not, they know the stories of the defectors. I mean, there's thousands of defectors that live in South Korea. And, people in the South understand that their stories are often embellished. The more horrible your story is made out to be, the more exposure you'll get in the media. And that's especially true here in the U.S. And so, you know, the for one thing, like, for example, a newspaper like Hankyore, Hankyoreh, which has an English language site, they're very good, and you can read, you know, it's easy to find, get access to their articles. There's also an organization in D.C. called 38 North. It's based in a think tank here. And it's been around for a while, and it's run by the chairperson of it is, or the president of it is Robert Gallucci, who negotiated the 1994 nuclear agreement with North Korea. And 38 North has a lot of writers that and analysts that you know look at North Korea, and they often analyze satellite imagery. For example, they've been doing this for a few years, you know, looking at what's going on at certain of the nuclear sites or missile sites, and they try to analyze, you know, analyze what's going on there in terms of their weapons programs by, you know, comparing it to imagery they can get. But they also do very good, looking deeply at certain issues. Like, for example, after Trump announced the other day, when I was in Singapore, he announced to my shock, surprise, that he was going to cancel these U.S. South Korean military drills, military exercises that have been seen as, you know, that North Korea, one of the reasons they were developing their nuclear weapons was to counter those exercises and the threat they represent. He said they would cancel them. After he did that, 38 North put out a very detailed report about, you know, why stopping these exercises is a good idea, and really showing what they, you know, what their purpose is, and how North Korea would see them as a threat, so Americans can understand it, you know. And instead, you know, what we get here is like, oh my God, he canceled these military exercises, and now you have Democrats introducing legislation, you know, to stop the Trump administration from making any changes in terms of, you know, U.S. troops in South Korea and this kind of thing. And they're saying that he gave away everything by canceling these exercises. North Korea gave nothing in return. All that's not true. But, you know, if you want to end war and you're trying to do step-by-step move to you know, get there and get to an agreement, You know, stopping these exercises is really key to that.
Well, and Tim, this was huge, because so many people did not expect this, as you said. And what was interesting is to watch some of the cable shows actually have a conversation and talk about how much money the United States actually spends on the military, which the cable shows rarely do. But when we say war games, can you be specific? What exactly is the U.S. doing in South Korea? And what do we mean by war games exactly?
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, there's this deep alliance, you know, military alliance with South Korea and the United States that's been in place, you know, since the end of the Korean War. And since the 1970s, the two militaries began conducting these rather large scale military exercises, where they basically practice, you know, what would happen in another Korean War. Like, they run through drills like, you know, how the U.S. and South Korean militaries would respond if North Korea attacked South Korea again, okay? So, you know, that in itself, is nothing wrong with keeping your military in readiness. But over the last 10 years, the exercises have increased in scope, and so for example, last year there was one of the big exercises. There was two U.S. aircraft carriers. You know, these are nuclear powered and nuclear armed aircraft carriers. There were strategic bombers like B-52s and B-2 bombers that carry nuclear weapons, and fighter planes that carry them. And they practiced not only, you know, defensive exercises, but they practice offensive, you know, invading North Korea. They practice what they call regime change, what they call is regime decapitation. So last year, on one of the submarines that the U.S. had in the exercises, SEAL Team 6 was on board. We all know SEAL Team 6 is the team that assassinated Osama bin Laden. And they had them on board, to practice, going in and assassinating Kim Jong-un. So, of course, any country, albeit, a police state, authoritarian country, is gonna take offense at, military drill that practices the assassination of its own leaders, right? So that's what's the part that's really missing from this, and why a lot of people that know about Korea, think that changing these exercises, and scaling them down or ending them is a really good idea.
According to The Hill, the United States has about 28,500 troops stationed in South Korea. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's maybe closer to 30,000 or so.
Wow.
The important thing to know about the U.S. military presence in South Korea is that they have a joint command. This is this very unique situation where it's a joint U.S. South Korea military command, and right now it's headed by a South Korean general. In times of peace, it is headed by a South Korean general, but if it ever goes into a war situation, the commander becomes the U.S. commander takes over. And so you would have a country, the only country in the world, where a foreign general would command its troops in times of war. That's pretty unusual. So, the U.S. has this very, very deep alliance, and it, cuts across all, every aspect of the military as well as intelligence. And so, it's a very integrated, these two militaries are very integrated. And so it's a very, complex, alliance, but very, very powerful as well.
We're speaking with Tim Shorrock, an independent journalist who just got back from Singapore, where he covered the meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. He wrote a piece for The Nation about it. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Tim will be with us for about 7 more minutes. If you have any questions or comments about what he saw there, his reporting, what do you think of all of the nonstop coverage that this meeting got? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Tim, one more question about Trump's comments about war games. What tends to happen with Trump is he will say something that no one expects, and then his circle will get to him, and all of a sudden they'll do the complete opposite. So, for example, during the debates, Trump often criticized the invasion of Iraq. He often criticized George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, who was on stage with him. I mean, he almost sounded like, he opposed the Iraq invasion. He sounded more dovish than most of the Democrats. But then when you look at what he does, his cabinet is full of hawks, including John Bolton.
Right.
So that's what we're seeing from him. He speaks off the cuff, but then when people get to him, they do the exact opposite.
But also when he, when he wants something, he will overrule those advisors. So, in the case of Korea, of course, a lot of people were very concerned when, he named Bolton National Security Advisor because, for years, John Bolton has been this, this arch foe of North Korea. And he used to say, what our policy toward North Korea should be no more North Korea. In other words, regime change. He was very, very set on, getting rid of North Korea, and that was his idea. And he used to, ridicule the whole idea of negotiations with them. And here he was, in Singapore, shaking the hand of Kim Jong-un. There's a picture of him doing that. So it's Trump is strange. On Korea, he says really surprising things to me about it. Like, for example, he's talked about the terrible nature of how terrible the Korean War was. And, you don't get too many presidents saying that. And I think he's he comes at it, he doesn't really know that much until he gets into it, and so he kind of reacts. Like, you know, the other day he was saying, I just don't understand why you have these B-52s flying from Guam, you know, and dropping bombs on South Korea. And he called these exercises, again, you know, provocative. So that's just kind of like initial response. And so sometimes his initial response is good, but then, of course, you know, the policymakers come in and want to change it. But, you know, I think on this issue, you know, he's been able to really say, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have these negotiations, and I'm bent on doing it despite what you, John Bolton, you know, may think. And so Bolton kind of went along with it. You know, on the other hand, you know, Bolton may be a much worse influence in terms of Iran policy. And that's where I kind of fear where he may, you know, be very dangerous in terms of, you know, pushing the U.S. into a confrontation with Iran after scuttling this Iran, you know, nuclear deal. So it's, you know, we have this president that's very, you know, unconventional, obviously, and you know, very despised. And I think that's where a lot of the coverage comes from on the sort of left liberal press, is that, of course, you know, people don't like him, and for many, many valid reasons. But, I mean, in this case, you know, ending the Korean War and moving Korea toward a peace regime is a great feat, and I think we should applaud it, you know, as Americans, and, you know, be glad for the Korean people.
Well, what do you think will actually come of this? Because that's the other question, is what does this joint statement actually include? You write that it includes a pledge to build a lasting and robust peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. What does that mean exactly?
Well, and they also quoted in their agreement, they quoted from the Panmunjom that was issued when Kim Jong-un went to South Korea on the south side of the DMZ and met with President Moon Jae-in in late April, and they crafted this declaration. Well, you know, what that means is you know, moving Korea away from a state of war and, you know, getting to a peace treaty to formally end the Korean War and normalizing relations between the U.S. and North Korea. That, you know, that's sort of the intention there. And they, you know, they both, you know, signed a paper that, you know, focused on, you know, North Korea will agree to denuclearization, but it's, you know, it's going to be a step-by-step process. And so, you know, North Korea actually has given some major concessions for, you know, it stopped their testing of their missiles and their and any kind of nuclear devices. And, you know, by the way, last year, you know, it stopped testing, you know, before it had actually completed building a missile that could hold a nuclear warhead and go through the atmosphere and hit a target. So, you know, they stopped their program short of actually having a full-fledged, you know, nuclear capability. And that was very important, I think, in actually, you know, convincing the Trump administration to begin talks. So, you know, I think the important thing about, you know, including the Panmunjom Declaration is that, you know, South Korea and North Korea are sort of going to be at the center of this. But I think, you know, we're already seeing, like, you know, I think that the new denuclearization process is going to begin by them in North Korea identifying, you know, where their weapons are, what their weapons are, the various sites where they make them, you know, who the scientists are and that kind of thing. And then, you know, they'll have to negotiate a verification system, a verification process involving, you know, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Association, that, you know, has been there before to do these inspections, and then, you know, maybe even having people on the ground, the U.S. people on the ground. The other important part of their agreement was to, you know, get the remains of U.S. soldiers killed and missing in action during the Korean War. You know, the U.S. and North Korea were doing that for a while until about 10 years ago when relations really went downhill. But, you know, like Trump kind of made this blunder by saying, you know, some parents had told him, and, you know, please get your son out of North Korea. And then, you know, people said, how could they be parents of North Korean, you know, soldiers who were in the Korean War? But the fact is, there are many military families of people that died there and were missing there, who still long to have their, you know, the completion of their story and have their remains returned. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having that done is really, I mean, that's a great thing. And that helps North Korea and the U.S. build trust with each other.
And Tim, just before we let you go, we're going to have to do a longer show about this, but we have a question from a listener on Facebook who says, can you talk about the abuses of U.S. soldiers against Korean women? I mean, this is a big story.
This has been a problem at any place where there's U.S. bases around the world. And you know, it's been most pronounced, though, in Okinawa, where, you know, in Japan, 70% of the U.S. bases in Japan are in the island of Okinawa. And that's where there's been a lot of, you know, rapes and murders. In Korea, it hasn't been such a problem, but, I mean, you know, there's around these bases, there's always, you know, women or, you know, there's brothels set up for, you know, U.S. soldiers. And, you know, there was a big, you know, almost a crisis about 15 years ago when two U.S. soldiers, you know, were driving a Jeep and they killed a young Korean girl. And the thing is, like, they're not prosecuted in the Korean justice system. They're, you know, kind of prosecuted in the U.S. military justice system. And a lot of Koreans feel that they get off easily. Mm. But, you know, so, I mean, I think this is kind of a terrible problem around U.S. bases in general. But I think it's been, as I said, it's been more pronounced in Okinawa than South Korea.
Well, Tim, I know you just landed from Singapore, so you're exhausted. Thank you for your reporting, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tim Shorrock is an independent journalist, frequent contributor to The Nation. You can see his reporting at yourcallradio.org and author of Spies for Hire. Coming up after a break, we will talk about coverage of the thousands of children being kept in immigration detention centers. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on the show. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, more on the week's news on 1A with Joshua Johnson from Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and now we are going to talk about media coverage of immigration and children who have been separated from their families. This is getting widespread media attention. Yesterday, there were protests across the country, and today there will be more protests. If you are in the Bay Area, there's going to be a protest at the ICE Field Office, 630 Sansom in San Francisco, at 4 o'clock. And joining us to talk about coverage is Alice Driver, a freelance journalist focusing on human rights, migration, and gender equality. Alice is the author of More or Less Dead: Feminicide, Haunting, and the Ethics of Representation in Mexico. And Alice just wrote an op-ed for CNN called Trump's Zero Tolerance Policy is Un-American. Alice Driver joins us from Mexico City. Hi, Alice. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to start off with you by talking about how we got here, because there's been so much attention on this. But what about the context? The Texas Observer has a piece by Forrest Wilder called The Disturbing Path That Leads to Child Prison Camps. And Forrest points out that some of these proposals are new and some are not new. What's not new is locking up families in penal-like facilities or even tent cities for immigrants, including kids. This happened under George W. Bush. The immigrant incarceration complex really boomed. And then under Obama, officially, they ended family detention, but in 2014, as a large influx of asylum seekers arrived at the Texas-Mexico border from Central America, the Obama administration reopened two new family detention centers in South Texas. So can you give us a little bit of context and talk about how we got here?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that's really interesting, I mean, yes, under previous administrations, including Obama, there were cases where parents were separated from children. But I think what we're seeing under Trump is a huge overstep of any kind of policy that has ever been in place in terms of the way that the families are treated and the way that they're separated. Because what's happening now is that parents are being sent to federal criminal prisons and children can't be there. So the children are being sent through a separate, through the Office of Refugee Resettlement and are being placed, what seems to be quite haphazardly, anywhere, not near their parents, not in the same state, not with family members, maybe on a military base. And this is at a time when we have seen the ACLU just released a report on abuses of children in detention. And so do you really want to be separating, you know, we've got children under the age of four, babies. I mean, there was a story on CNN about a breastfeeding mother who was separated from her child. And the other thing that I've seen in my interviews that I think needs to be pointed out is that these parents, often when they're separated from their children, they have said that, for example, an ICE agent told them, oh, I'm going to take your son to shower, or I'm going to take your daughter to get something to eat. And then the children never reappear. Who behaves like that? That is not legal.
Well, and then the thing I've been thinking about all week is, how are these authorities keeping track of these parents and their children? How are the right children going to be reunited with their parents?
And that's a really good question, especially when you've got so many people who don't speak Spanish. Imagine, or you're imagining you're separating a one-year-old child or a five-year-old child, that, and you tell the parents, oh, I'm taking them to get something to eat, and they never see their parents again. You know, how does that child then find their parents, or how does a baby find their parents? I mean, I find it really disconcerting that this is the process that we as a nation are supporting right now.
Alice Driver is a freelance journalist focusing on human rights and migration. And now I would like to welcome Manny Fernandez to the show. Manny is Houston Bureau Chief for the New York Times. On Wednesday, Manny was one of a small group of reporters who toured a former Walmart that has been converted into a migrant children's shelter in Brownsville, Texas. He found nearly 1,500 boys there aged 10 to 17. Hi, Manny. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, to that question, Manny, were you able to ask any of the authorities, how are you planning to reunite these children with their parents?
You know, during our media tour, the federal officials and the operator of the shelter claimed that they do just that, that they have reunited families and that there is a system in place so that reunification can happen. And again, this is what they said happened. And I'm sure that there's problems in that system, but that's what they claim.
And tell us more about this media tour. Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA, was on MSNBC last weekend, and she said that she has tried but could not get into any of these facilities. At that point, no journalist had gotten in. So at what point were you invited to see this facility?
So, you know, I think what happened is I, like, you know, dozens or, I don't know, of other reporters asked for tours, for media tours, a lot of these facilities. particularly after the senator from Oregon tried to get in but was refused. A number of media outlets asked for interviews, and the standard reply was no, but if we do something, we'll get back in touch with you. And, you know, the administration and also the operator of the shelter had a fairly low-key response during that whole controversy after the senator tried to get in and they called the police on him. And so it took a few days, and then I think suddenly they started up their sort of PR strategy and did invite, a select group of reporters to go on the tour of this Walmart facility. And so I think overall, it's just part of this new approach where they do want to put their site out. They do want to release pictures of what it looks like inside. There's another media tour supposed to happen of a shelter in California today. There's also congressional delegations touring the former Walmart site on Sunday and on Monday. So they're sort of changing it around, and they are now sort of gearing up the process to say, here's what they look like, here's what we have to show you.
The former Walmart that you visited is a 250,000 square foot facility, and it's in Brownsville, Texas. You found about 1,500 boys there, ages 10 to 17. Is there another shelter that houses girls?
Yes, there's actually a number of shelters. So this is just one of several in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas. Southwest Key, which is the operator of this former Walmart facility, I think they have about four or five others in the Brownsville area. And these other ones, they're a lot smaller. They only handle 200 kids, 400. And so, yes, the girls and other children, younger children, are at other facilities. This one is the biggest in the country, and for whatever reason, it only holds boys. And it only holds boys from age 10 to 17.
And Alice, you wrote an op-ed for CNN about this. What are some of the other questions that we still don't have answers to?
One of the questions is, how are families that cross the border and request asylum being treated? Because cases of asylum shouldn't be treated the same as the cases that the Trump administration has been taking of people, quote, illegally crossing the border. And yet we have heard stories reported that some of these families that request asylum are also being separated forcibly. And so I think that's something that also needs to be considered. There's so much going on in terms of Sessions and others in the administration citing Bible passages about separating immigrants. It's hard to bring together all the things that are the sort of the reasons that are being used by the administration for these policies.
Right, and for people who haven't been following that, I'm just reading from CNN right now. Jeff Sessions cited the Bible on Thursday in defending the administration's immigration policies, especially those that result in the separation of families, during his remarks in particular to, quote, church friends. He said, I would cite to you the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command to obey the laws of the government. In some ways, Alice, so much of this is a distraction from what's actually happening. I mean, how do you think the media should deal with something like this when Sessions cites the Bible?
We as the media need to be really careful and thinking, I mean, first of all, we're not a nation church state. And second of all, in terms of thinking about specifically about these children who are being housed in shelters, for example, I saw today that a reporter said that the children at the shelter looked happy. And I know that reporters weren't allowed to talk to the children. Manny can probably speak to this, but I don't think that reporters should be saying, oh, the children looked happy, if you've never interviewed or spoken to the children.
Manny, what about that?
Yes, I mean, we were not allowed to interview any children. and this is probably the biggest drawback, at least for me, after spending 90 minutes there, it was, you know, there were so many stories there, and you know, I could have spent days there just interviewing the children, but we were not allowed. Now, but we were allowed to sort of, you know, briefly interact with them, you know, in just a couple of moments, shaking their hands. You know, a lot of the children, they were smiling. They waved at the reporters. I shook a lot of their hands. The reporters and some of the Southwest Key officials asked them how they were doing. And, you know, they all said, bien, bien. You know, I mean, you know, okay, okay. You know, the, you know, and yeah, I mean, you know, in a quick brushstroke, a look at how people appeared. Yes, you know, I didn't see a lot of anguish. You know, again, I've visited prisons, I've visited immigration detention facilities, homeless shelters, you know, various types of facilities, facilities that came up in military bases in 2012. Housing unaccompanied youth, you know, and you know, this group of children that I saw, they were calm and settled, you know, and I'm sure that there's problems that happen, and I know there's problems that happen, and my story talks about some of these problems, you know, but I did not see a lot of anguish in the brief 90-minute tour that I had.
You also report, and this got a lot of attention, that inside of this particular shelter in Brownsville, Texas, again, it was a former Walmart, it is clean, massive, and brightly lit. Now, the obvious question there is, what happens when the media leave? What does it look like? I mean, did they just make it look nice and clean for the media? Is there any way of knowing?
You know, I mean, I'm sure they did a thorough cleaning, you know, before the media showed up. I'm sure that they were busy, you know, mopping the floors, right? But having said that, it is such a massive facility that there's only so much that they could do from the time that Senator Merkley tried to get in to the time that we entered that facility. You know, it's so huge with more than 1,000 employees, you know, that they were limited in any sort of band-aids that they could put up. There's just not time. You know, there's rooms that are constructed. There are, when you're inside of it, it's easy to forget that it's a Walmart because they have essentially built classrooms. They've built offices. They've done so much reconstruction and spent a lot of money on that facility that I don't know how much they could have done in a short time. And by the way, that was one of the questions that they did not answer, was any financial questions. All the reporters are asked them, you know, how much do they charge to the government per child, per bed? And they said they didn't have those numbers in front of them, and that they would get back to us. And they have not done that.
Yeah, I was also wondering about that. Manny Fernandez is Houston Bureau Chief for the New York Times. On Wednesday, he was one of a small group of reporters who toured a former Walmart that has been converted into a migrant children's detention center in Brownsville, Texas. 1,500 boys are there, aged 10 to 17, and Manny was there for 90 minutes. He was not allowed to interview any of the children. We're also joined today by Alice Driver, a freelance journalist focusing on human rights, migration, and gender equality. And she's got a piece in CNN called Trump's Zero Tolerance Policy is Un-American. If you have any questions or comments for our guests about media coverage of immigration and children who have been separated from their children, I mean from their families, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Alice, I wanted to ask you about the children, because doctors are now speaking out. A number of organizations including the American College of Physicians, the American Psychiatric Association, about 250,000 doctors have sent letters to the Department of Homeland Security calling for a change of course. Dr. Ana Maria Lopez, president of the American College of Physicians, told reporters yesterday that the effect of this type of event will follow these children into adulthood and into their entire lives. Our federal government is causing a situation that's creating a host of potential health consequences for an entire category of people.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we don't know what the effects of this will be, but we're talking about, and I've been primarily working in Central America, traveling and living with migrants, including families and children, and the trauma of what they're fleeing, you know, including drug violence, including families, family members who've been murdered, including, you know, violence and abuse along the migrant trail. They're arriving in the United States at, you know, their most vulnerable point. And we are investing our money in building, apparently now we're going to build tent shelters for children. And so the question is really, you know, do we care at all about these children, and what are we investing our money in? Because clearly they need very specific kinds of help, and it's unlikely that they're going to get that in a Walmart or, you know, in a tent somewhere on the, you know, near the Texas border.
Manny, what would you add?
You know, I mean, there are a couple things that, that jumped out at me, you know, after the tour, you know, and one of them that hasn't been a lot of attention on it is that, so there were two sets of boys in this former Walmart. There were the young boys who came across the border unaccompanied, right? They were apprehended by Border Patrol without any parent or guardian. And then there was the other set, which is the set that was, that the government had made an unaccompanied minor because the government had separated them from their families. And so those are two different sort of types of children, right? You have some that sort of came over without their families, and you have others that did come over with their families, but now they're separated from them. And those dynamics are something that needs more exploring, and, you know, we didn't get enough answers in our brief tour on that, but I think it's an important moment is that you have shelters created for children that came over unaccompanied, and they sort of knew what that journey was about going into it. And then you have these other children who were suddenly separated from their families, and it's a different, almost psychological dynamic, and I think that's something that needs more exploring.
Right. And to your point, Alice, when we do shows about immigration, we had a guest on a couple of years ago who actually crossed the border with immigrants. And this is something that we don't spend much time on. But even things like having to avoid rattlesnakes at night, they tend to walk so the ICE can't see them or Border Patrol can't see them. And they often run into very sharp cacti and they get lots of cuts on their bodies. I mean, this is just, even crossing the border is such a traumatic experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of experiences. I mean, I've even had, I was living in a migrant shelter in Juarez, working on a story for Long Reads last year, and some of the migrants said that they had been, you know, they had gone to sleep on the Mexico border in Chiapas and woken up surrounded by alligators. So,
oh, wow.
You've got all kinds of issues with wildlife and with cold and hunger. So I don't know, just adding to this situation, the fact of separating young children from their parents and not doing it even in an ethical way. I mean, I think that's a huge issue.
We have time for one call and one email. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I would like to make a comment that I've not seen addressed at all in any media, NPR, New York Times, anything. What Sessions, Trump, the ICE, and the Border Patrol are doing is kidnapping. They're taking children by force from parents without parents' permission and shipping them across state lines many times. And why is this, and kidnapping is a federal crime, why are people not calling this out?
Why aren't people calling it kidnapping?
Why are they not calling it kidnapping? Mm.
Alice?
I mean, I think just like anything, because currently those in power are defining this legally as a process that's part of immigration, and they're setting it up, you know, by prosecuting parents and pushing them through the federal prison system. They're saying, oh, well, children can't be there, so we have to separate them. So it's really how the powers that be are defining this issue, and we have to think about that more.
And we have an email from David who says, how can individuals help these kids and their families? What can we do to stop these separations?
Well, I think in terms of what I've seen, I mean, obviously talking to your lawmakers is important, supporting advocacy organizations and protesting. I mean, those are all things, and I think it's really important to do that on a community level and to work or volunteer with immigrants. Really, I mean, that's, people need to be reminded of the humanity of others.
There were protests across the country yesterday. If you're in the Bay Area, there was one at 4 o'clock at the ICE field office, 630 Sansom in San Francisco. And Manny, to your point about what this is costing taxpayers and how, you know, who's profiting off of this, the Daily Beast ran a piece yesterday called Defense Contractors Cashing In on Immigrant Kids Detention. A scandal-plagued company that used to work for the CIA is poised to profit off the influx of immigrant children being forcibly separated from their parents. One of these groups or firms is Virginia-based MVM, and it's ensuring the children's shelter meets, quote, policy and procedures set by the Department of Health and Human Services. This piece reports that these companies are posting a number of open jobs in these children detention centers. Are you planning to write a piece that follows the money, Manny?
Yes, I'm planning follow-ups more about, yes, the immigrant shelters and how they run and who runs them and different problems they have and different violations. But, you know, yes, I mean, it's big business. Just in the tour, you know, that I had the other day, you know, the amount of clothes, the amount of bed sheets, you know, the costs and the money is just tremendous. You know, there's 1,500 children, and what they were telling me is that, you know, every day new children come in, other children go out, and it's a daily intake and outtake that happens. And all of those, you know, kids, they need food. You know, I mean, I remember there were these, the children had next to their beds these sort of croc style black sandals, and I believe that every bed had this set of sandals next to it. And, you know, that the money is just a huge sort of unanswered question. And if I can jump in also, that someone mentioned
just briefly,
what can you do? Yeah, someone mentioned, what can you do? A lot of the people that run these shelters, they do have volunteer programs. And so I'm not sure how active or robust those volunteer programs still are with so much attention being put on these immigrant children shelters. But there are ways to volunteer at these specific shelters. And they do select certain volunteers from the community to come in and to help out in various ways. So,
Manny Fernandez is Houston Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Alice Driver is a freelance journalist. Manny and Alice, thank you both for your reporting. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.